all, welcome everyone to this term's Majewski lecture. I'm very pleased indeed to welcome Dr. Arko Lonkumer, who is the lecturer in the study of religions in the theology faculty. And he's done work with the Nagas in India, and he has interests, theoretical interests in the anthropology of religion and theory of religion. And today he's going to share with us some of his research on pilgrimage and ritual space in the Bhuban Cave, Assam, India. Contested meanings, pilgrimage and ritual space in the Bhuban Cave, Assam, India. So I very much look forward to hearing what he has to tell us.
Thank you. okay. All right, so I'll just talk about the pilgrimage that I undertook with a group of Haraka people in Assam, India. And this is a very reflexive paper in that it was kind of very ethnographic. And so, so I will start it off. Bhuban Hill is in the district of Assam, around 50 kilometers southwest of Silchar. The area that I'm talking about is primarily Assam there, as you can see. And this is a map of Assam, and Kachar is at the bottom of the screen there. Every year, Haraka pilgrims from all over the region visit the Bhuban Cave, situated near the top of Bhuban Hill, during the month of February. For the Haraka, the Bhuban Cave represents the point from where the reform began during the 1920s, where God Tingwang, or Sky God, instructed the first reformers. Why is the pilgrimage of such importance to the Haraka even after so many years? Before I begin answering the question, let me first elaborate on some concepts and ideas. The Haraka are a socio-religious reform movement from Pau Paise ancestral practice, popular amongst the Zemi Nagas of three northeastern Indian states of Assam, Nagaland, and Manipur. The central reform of the Haraka is that they have adopted a single sky god, Tingwang, and have abolished sacrifices associated with the smaller gods. As I've argued elsewhere, this abolishment of sacrifices was primarily for economic reasons. Therefore, the very meaning behind Haraka envisages a state where very smaller gods are fenced out to accommodate Tingwang, the sky god. The majority of the Haraka adherents live in the North Kachar Hills, Assam. The history of the Haraka movement has evolved through various stages. It was principally organized under the second prophet, Rani Gaidinlu, who took over the remnants of the movement from her cousin Jadunong after he died in the early 1930s. Although some scholars hold the view that Jadunong initiated the reforms and is the principal founder of the Haraka movement, most Haraka adherents look to Rani Gaidinlu as the initiator of the reforms, because the Haraka movement developed separately in Assam and in Nagaland after Jadunong's death in Manipur. The reforms from Pau Paise, initiated by Rani Gaidinlu, made the Haraka highly popular in the North Kachar Hills. It is now the dominant religious group among the Zemi, followed by the Christians and the ancestral practice or Pau Paise. So let us return to the question, why is the pilgrimage of such importance to the Haraka even after so many years? Because in many ways the pilgrimage encapsulates the Haraka reform and the relationship with the many religious traditions. This relationship gives rise to themes such as identity, religious boundaries, and reform itself. A second reason the pilgrimage connects with the Haraka is, in such a powerful way, is that it reiterates their bond with the essence of what Haraka is. In the cave, the blessing of Ting Wong was bestowed upon Jodenong and Wadi Gaidinlu, who were then instructed to teach the people. Past pilgrims told me about the immense power of the journey, how their emotions were affected by the awe-inspiring presence of the cave and its supposed miraculous effect on people making the pilgrimage. In the light of this, I will first describe Bhuvan Hill and the different symbols associated with it. Using individual accounts of Haraka followers, I will analyze how the reform is exemplified in the journey to the cave and how these experiences reveal the sacred, imaginative, and intuitive quality of what the reform represents. Second, I will examine the cave ritual as revealing the way the Haraka respond to and contrast themselves with the other religious traditions with whom they share the ritual space. Bhuvan Cave is an important place for the Haraka and also for the Paupai Chapriak, who contribute to the larger ethnic group known as Zilyangrong. So, who are the Paupai Chapriak? The Paupai Chapriak are Rongmai Nagas who count Jadanong as their reformer. Paupai Chapriak literally means Paupai as an ancestral, Chap, godly nature, and Riak. Riak has a variety of meanings. The existence of soul, mind, knowledge in the body and taking care of that body. The body and soul are kept holy by the power of our knowledge through introspection. This knowledge is known as Riak. There are also other religious groups who visit Bhuvan Hill. For example, it is known for a Shiva temple located above the Bhuvan Cave and constructed by the Kachari kings, a powerful kingdom in medieval Assam. Every year, there is a Shiva Yatra that is attended by hundreds of pilgrims. Therefore, Bhuvan Hill represents various cosmic worlds to different religious traditions. With this initial description, we are immediately drawn to ponder the significance associated with such a natural symbol as the hill. Why are people drawn to it? What is it that exudes such mystery and wonder? This hill is not just a hill with its rocky terrain and its natural formations, such as the cave and the deep underground tunnel, or its tall trees and natural springs. The hill also represents the human desire to relate to something they see as more than inanimate, as something sacred, etched into the memory of the people who walk on it, who revere it, and who interpret it in various ways as it evolves. The balance between the natural and the experiential is felt through human relations with the natural world and the metaphysical realities that bound their experience into a unique expression of their journey. Because a melange of religious traditions is associated with Bhuvan Hill, it is easy to assume that certain names, practices, or ideas derive from the dominant tradition with which they are primarily associated. This is so because identities are confusing, or in other words, there are no maps that indicate unambiguous religious boundaries, nor any list of defining characteristics which clearly divide one religious tradition from another. These categories, Haraka, Hindu, or Paupai Chapriya, are unimportant in social situations, i.e. sharing of food, campsite, and entertainment, because the pilgrims themselves do not recognize them, and the differences between the boundaries of each religious group, to the extent that they existed in the first place, become fuzzy. It is wrong to assume that these religious identities are fixed and that they in themselves represent identifying badges that signify their position and place in a hierarchy. It is only when religious traditions and their interpretations emerge, for example, in the sharing of ritual space in the cave with the Haraka and the Paupai Chapriya, that boundaries of identity become more obvious and divisive rather than unobtrusive and orderly. This sharing of ritual space is examined when considering the ritual of the cave. It is indeed more helpful to visualize Bhubon Hill as that which encapsulates all these worldviews and therefore represents a macrocosmic world. The climb to the cave is uphill for 2 hours or so, and one usually has to employ coolies or porters to carry most of the heavy load. As we walk up, we meet other pilgrims climbing up to the Shiva temple, smoking from their...
And they have the light in the light. Front.
Put the light off a bit.
I think that's the front light now.
There's a glossary here.
No, it must be on the other side. You think it's here?
No, these are all plums here. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, even some of the bigger ones might help. I know it's not open though.
But is it not clear? I mean, it's all right, isn't it?
It would be better if we
had some. I think it's here.
Yes.
This is the one. Oops! But then, when you have got the you got the lamp on your pedestal.
Right.
Is there not a lamp there?
There is a lamp here.
There's enough light, huh?
Is it switched on at the wall?
Yeah, I think it is.
Oh, wow.
Well, I think it's all right. I mean, because I think I can see, so we'll...
As long as you can read your paper.
Yes, yeah. where was I? Yeah. Smoking from their wooden chillums or smoking pipes. Once we reach level ground again, a sign nailed to a tree indicates that we have to take a right turn to the Naga Vishnu Cave. Once we reach level ground again, this is the same as the Bhubon Cave. The name Naga Vishnu has been put up at least for two reasons. One, to indicate to the Hindus, and two, to the non-Christian Nagas. It could also be assumed that this indicates a site for Hindu pilgrims because of certain semantic similarities. Indeed, some people attending the pilgrimage may interpret it as having some connection with the Hindu Vishnu. For example, Ziliang, a local scholar, associates Bhuvan Cave with the abode of Vishnu by equating Tingwang, which is the god of the sky, with Vishnu. However, in the present context, it is important to privilege local categories over pan-Indian Hindu categories. I am therefore hesitant to tie the name Naga Vishnu Cave with the aforementioned point because, as we shall see, it is not that simple. The Bhuvan Cave is below the Shiva Temple, and those interested in going further have another half an hour's climb before like reaching the top. This is a rough sketch of the hill that I'm talking about. I hope it's clear there. We make our way to the main camp rather than the cave. I am struck immediately by the throngs of pilgrims who have come to attend the pilgrimage.
So back to the PowerPoint, sorry. F5.
My friends and I settled down for some tea while people below us prepare for evening rituals. Another Paupai Chapriak pilgrims are just making their way to the pilgrimage, and they carry with them animals and various birds such as pigeons and hens as they sing songs and line up outside the two Paupai Chapriak temples, Naga Vishnu Mandir and Gariyamang Memorial Hall. That's the Naga Vishnu Mandir out there. And you can see pilgrims kind of coming in with their gifts of animals. And the other one is Gariyamang Memorial Hall. The two temples are revered only by the Paupai Chapriaks and not by the Haraka. The Paupai Chapriak pilgrims have obviously had a long journey carrying their heavy bundles, but their tiredness seemed effaced by the sight of the gods inside the temples. They remove their shoes just as they approach the steps leading to the Naga Vishnu temple and place the animals marked with pink dye on the steps of the altar as a gift to the gods. After praying, the priest sprinkles water with a plantain leaf, a symbol of purity, on the pilgrims. A tiny bell is then rung as a completion of the ritual. The first temple, which houses Vishnu, is called Naga Vishnu Mandir. That's the first. And the other one is called Gariyamang Memorial Hall. Inside the temples, the figures of Bhuvan and Gariyamang are adorned with full Rongmai regalia in the traditional red, white, and black body cloths. A Rongmai spear is erected beside them, and a few trishuls or tridents are also placed behind the spear. Both these temples, according to the Paupai Chapriya, were built on original sites. What these original sites represented is not clear, but one general assumption is that these sites were venerated as holy places by the Paupai Chapriya since time immemorial, and the temples were built to signify and preserve the holy place. According to the myth, Bhuvan God begot a son called Garyamang. He was given all sorts of powers, talent, wisdom, and beauty. At that time, there was a belief among the Zelyangrong people that a king will come to bring peace. People thought that Garyamang was the prophesied one. But instead of living up to his promises, he squandered all his talents and became a womanizer. All his blessings were withdrawn from him, and the Zelyangrong people waited for the return of another king who would bring peaceful rule. What the notion of this king implies remains elusive to this day. Some say that Jadunong fits in with this image, but his premature death and the ascendancy of Rani Gaidinlu as a leader creates counter claims supported by texts that Rani Gaidinlu was chosen over Jadunong to lead the people. The main temple, Naga Bishnu Mandir, houses Bishnu, who is also known as Bhuban. The semantic variation is figured in the different oral and written accounts where names or even spellings change to suit their context. This shows the difficulty of defining categories and their evolution. For example, Bishnu has gone on to incorporate various changes that reflect how local worldviews assimilate the larger ones or vice versa in processes called parochialization and universalization, respectively. Bishnu is the Bengali Orongmai spelling. In Zemi, he's called like Munsinu, sometimes spelled also as like Mishnu. The Zemi Haraka say that Munsinu resided in what is now called Bhuban Cave. Just to illustrate. Now, I want you to just ignore this part here and concentrate on this part here. Because it kind of gives you the various breakdowns of how Mishnu or like Bishnu has been altered. Jadunong, on the other hand, claims that Kangre Long, who's there, the god of Bhuban Hills, appeared to him in a dream. In another account, Rani Gaidinlu is questioned by the political agent of Assam, J.C. Higgins, in 1932 about Jadunong's activities. She replies that, and I quote, "I also went to Bhuban to worship the god in order to obtain prosperity, because Jadunong said that he was going, and because the people of the plains, i.e. the people of Kachar, worshipped there." This claim suggests that there have been local Hindu influences in the way Bishnu is represented and adopted by the people. Moreover, the name Bhuban initially may have come from the Shiva temple called Bhubaneswar Temple, situated above the cave site, and perhaps originally from Orissa. Possibly, Jadunong and Gaidinlu heard of the temple and visited the site as the people of the plains were doing, perhaps to give some sort of legitimacy to their reform message. Clearly, in this case, Bishnu seems to be semantically similar to Vishnu, and the connection between Bhuban and Munsinu is probably a later identification brought about by the reformers who had access to Bhuban Hill. However, there is no obvious acknowledgement by the Paupai Chapriyaks or the Haraka that this is the case. For them, Bhuvan, Munshinu, and Bishnu are clearly the same as well as local. The point is strongly asserted by a local scholar, Gangmumai Kamai, when he says, and I quote, "God Bishnu is not the Hindu god Vishnu. Bishnu is the god of the Zhelyangrong pantheon." There are various possibilities that emerge from this discussion. Generally, there is much Sanskritic terminology used by the Haraka and Paupai Chapriya. For example, Bishnu, Bhuvan, Pujari, and so on and so forth. Clearly, at some point, there has been a Brahminic, a Vaishnava, and or Shaiva influence on what was more ancient site. The Nagas could have been involved before or after this. If before, they seem to have accepted the identification of local gods with pan-Hindu deities and then made some attempt to re-localize them. If after, they attempted to associate with powerful external gods such as Vishnu, who possibly represented an almighty presence similar to their own god. This discussion illustrates the complexity of identification of gods on the ground because of the numerous ways it is appropriated, used, and understood. So let us return to the pilgrimage to the cave. Early the next morning at 5 o'clock, we made the trek towards the cave. There is an entrance to cross to get to the level ground in front of the mouth of the cave. We remove our shoes and place them just outside this entrance. The crowd has already gathered there facing east towards the entrance made by the prophet Rani Gaidinlu. People are dressed in their traditional attire. As the sun slowly rises up above the hills, and at this exact moment they perform the sunrise prayer.
So let's I'll go back to the PowerPoint.
So that's the sunrise prayer there. Actually, I can't really see the script now, so is it possible if we switch the light on?
Okay. Well,
you can probably
dim
the lights, but I'm not sure how.
I don't know how. Yeah. Anyways, I guess this will have to do. The sunrise prayer begins with three young boys dressed in traditional Zemi clothes saluting to the sun. It resembles a physical drill, a slowly choreographed jumping jack routine with a military-style salute. The people sing a song, Cheham Arani, three times, signifying the process of rebirth, life, death, and then life again. When the song finishes, a Haraka elder steps forward away from the people and says a prayer with folded hands. Then they slowly turn around and facing the cave sing the song I Liangrina Ragwan Gaye three times. Once the sunrise ritual is over, the crowd light their candles and make their way down to the cave. Entering the cave is like crossing a threshold from one place to another. It is the place where God Ting Wong manifested himself to the reformers and therefore acknowledged as points on earth specially suited for approach to the deity. For here, the invisible transcendent deity has been proven to be accessible. Bubon Cave became an important place of pilgrimage for Gaidinlu as well as Jadunong, and it is here that they receive their religious training and instructions for the reforms. According to Gaidinlu's account, they receive instructions about the construction of temples, arrangement of flowers on the altar, initiatory rites, song and dance arrangements, as well as the organization of villages and how to reduce animal sacrifices. It is through a goddess called Nam Ginai that Gaidinlu meets Ting Wong in Bubon Cave. There is a particular incident inside the cave that Gaidinlu recounts. On the 26th of January 1930, Gaidinlu and her followers reached the cave. It was quiet when suddenly a strange light illuminated the cave. There in front of them, Goddess Nam Ginai suddenly appeared. She was visible only to those who had faith in the goddess. So, elated by the incident, they started singing praise songs. Pilgrims also commonly narrate such unusual occurrences. Paolo, a Zemi Haraka, told me of her experience in the cave, and I quote, "When I visited the cave the first time, nothing happened, but on the roof of the cave I saw a form of a tiger. The second time I saw a soldier, but I can't remember what he was carrying. The third time I saw a statue of a sadhu, or a priest. A prophet from the Zemi community, Kwame, told me that when we see pictures of saints, God will bless those who are witnessed such an event, and I was indeed blessed. The fourth time, I saw a mithun, which is also an Indian bison. The fifth time, I saw a statue of Rani Gaidinlu. On this visit, along with my friends, we came down and took the ashes from the fire in front of the cave as a cure for our cough." In a way, the cave represents a sacred place for the pilgrims, because from one perspective, the cave can be seen as emanating directly from the matrix of an animate landscape that has certain associations with the people who have traversed the landscape over the years. From another perspective, the cave can be seen as the consecration of the territory via divine interventions whose power chose to channel it through particular sites and to particular people. In this sense, the cave has both a place-centered and person-centered sacredness. Reflecting on the notion of the sacred through the anthropology of Christian pilgrimage, John Eade and Michael Salno note that the sacred can be seen as both timeless and ahistorical, as well as anchored in society and history. The Haraka reverence for Gaidinlu and the importance of the cave for them clearly highlights the importance of the place as well as the person. Likewise, the narratives associated with the centrality of the cave and the pilgrims' experiences coalesce as both timeless and in history. However, it must be noted that the sacred cave, in this sense, is not inherently capable of producing a singular meaning to all the pilgrims. Moreover, I would argue that the intrinsic capacity of the cave is to provide a ritual space for the expression of a diversity of perceptions and meanings which the pilgrims, whether they are Hindu, Haraka or Paupai Chapriak, bring and impose upon it. The contestation over the ritual of sacrifice inside the cave illustrates this with more clarity. There are no easy paths down the cave. One has to step on protruding rocks, moist ground, and bat excrement. People whisper about the orange-clad sadhu, now who is making his way up effortlessly. He walks meditatively, perhaps aware of the throngs of silent people passing by, perhaps preoccupied with the blissful quiet of the abyss. One feels a sense of trepidation, perhaps a benign threat, as one ventures into the depths of the earth, as if sucked into a womb. Such fear is alleviated as the hundreds around walk in the solemn realization that they have come here not only to confront some fear, but also in an awareness that something might be gained. Old, young men and women walk hand in hand as they reach the base of the cave. Those who reach first start lighting candles and an incense on the big stone, which is used as an altar. Some women bring flowers, others money, and all put them on the altar situated in the middle of the cave, believed to be the place where Rani Gaidinlu prayed to God Ting Wong. Once most of the people have gathered below, each one of them takes a candle and circumambulates the large altar three times, representing the notion of life, death, and life. They move anti-clockwise whilst saying a silent prayer. The pilgrims believe that one of the most important and auspicious events for the Haraka is the pilgrimage to the cave. Ideally, it should be done three times over a lifetime. Because of the effort involved in accomplishing the pilgrimage, it is believed that prayers will be answered for rewards relating to the arduousness of the journey. The circumambulation of the altar represents completion, a ritual pattern that signifies what the Haraka promise, that there is life after death, symbolized by the circling of the stone. Once they complete the cycle, they offer their prayers again in front of the altar. When the prayers have been said, the younger people get ready to go down to the bottom of the cave through a tiny hole leading to an underground tunnel and the pond below. The water of the pond is supposed to be miraculous and a potent healing agent for sicknesses as well as ailments. They refer to the water as Talaundui, which is holy water. The young men and women gather their water jugs, large plastic canisters, and make their way through the tiny hole. The pilgrims fill the jug with this water, and most people carry it back to their respective villages that will be used for special ritual occasions. As most of the young people go down to retrieve the holy water, I stay back with a group of elders to talk about the importance of the cave. While we are conversing, a group of young Rongmai Paupai Chapriyaks arrive at the cave altar with some live hens. They say their prayers and then attempt to offer the hens to the god of the altar. A Haraka elder is standing beside the altar collecting the money left by the Haraka pilgrims. When the Paupai Chapriyak approach to put the hen as a gift on the altar, the Haraka elder absolutely refuses, saying, "This is not our custom." The Paupai Chapriyaks argue for a while, saying that there is nothing wrong in giving a gift to God by placing it on the altar. The Haraka elder retorts by saying that, and I quote, "In our custom, we do not follow any form of sacrifice or even gifts of animals to be placed before God." Annoyed by the situation, a Paupai Chapriyak places the hen on his forehead and lets go of the hen as an offering, watching it flutter over the altar to the obvious consternation of the Haraka elder. More and more Paupai Chapriyaks are coming down to the cave to perform their ritual before the altar. The Haraka people decide to leave the cave. They gather and together sing a closing song called Din Kuming before making the climb back to the top of the cave. As they are leaving, a Paupai Chapriyak priest storms into the cave. He comes running down hurriedly, uttering something in Rongmai. Behind him, his disciples are shouting, "Don't leave." It is obviously addressed to the Haraka. The remaining Haraka people ignore the plea and leave quietly. The Paupai Chapriyak priest stands in the altar and strikes his spear on the ground 5 times, angered by the refusal of the Haraka to listen to him. He stands there fuming, clad in his traditional clothes and covered in necklaces of prayer beads. For a moment, he just stands there. He then orders his disciples to clear and clean the altar with some water. The Haraka people have left candles, incense, and paper, which the priest considers a mess. A Paupai Chapriyak person later told me that the Haraka have left a mess and desacralized the holy space. The Paupai Chapriyaks then lit a fire and their ritual began. For this paper, I can't go into what the Paupai Chapriyak ritual was because it's quite lengthy, so I'll skip that and just talk a little bit more about the cave and the ritual. In this connection, I propose to draw attention to the way religious tension in the cave represents historical and theological differences between the two groups. In other words, the pilgrimage can be read as a field of social relations that reveal a realm of competing discourses. In his study of the high Andes of Peru, Michael Solnum argues that pilgrimages stimulate neighborhood factionalism, foster inter-community conflict, and generate new ethnically based hierarchies of control. In effect, says Solnum, when people converge in pilgrimages, meanings collide. Likewise, in the pilgrimage to the cave, a similar scene unfolds. Although they belong to a larger ethnic group, Zilyangrong, and experience relative calm at the sharing of the camp, when it comes to the religious enactment inside the cave, the scene is loaded with a meaning and is open to tension. While the cave represents different things for the various religious groups, the disputed space and rituals associated with it are deep-seated, embodied in the processes of history and its subsequent interpretations. While the Paupai Chapriak maintain their original and authentic status by declaring the preservation of traditional culture, the Haraka, on the other hand, argue that the origins of Haraka preceded those of Paupai Chapriak, and that Paupai Chapriak is but a corruption of the original Haraka. It is the Haraka who are original and authentic. This process of returning to the original state is the goal of the Haraka. For example, the rejection of sacrifices on the altar of the cave by the Haraka is not only connected with the gradual economic reforms which led to village reorganization during the mid-20th century, but it also imagines a state of purity where no sacrifices were necessary. The seeming disparity in their religious tradition becomes evident within the setting of the cave. For instance, the Haraka rotate around the big stone altar three times, anti-clockwise, while the Paupai Chapriak rotate five times, clockwise. For us, the cave is important because it is from here that we got our message, a Haraka elder in the pilgrimage told me. But there is no such importance for the Paupai Chapriak in the cave. The only reason they come to the cave is because of Rani Gaidinlu, and since she is herself a Rongmai, now the Paupai Chapriaks want to absorb her teachings into their practices and make it popular. In this case, instead of achieving or establishing harmony and cohesion, we see a reinforcing of social and religious boundaries rather than their attenuation. Moreover, these competing discourses are not only limited within the local sphere, but the way these boundaries reinforce regional and national affiliation are also evident, especially when they're associated with being Hindu. The pilgrimage often carries with it Hindu overtones, but both the Haraka and Paupai Chapriak deny any links with Hinduism. Due to their geography, that is being in Assam, the Paupai Chapriak are naturally influenced by Bengali Vaishnavism. They, however, vehemently say that they are not influenced at all by Hinduism or by the Shiva temple above. They claim that they are an indigenous faith who count Jadunong as a prophet, and he is the one who reformed their practice. The Harakas similarly reject any connection with Hinduism and also claim Jadunong as their prophet. Thus, we can conclude from our analysis of the pilgrimage and the cave ritual that there are many levels of meaning embedded in such a place because of vast intermingling and accretion that has happened over the years, Hindu, Haraka, and Paupai Chepriak. Each tradition is perhaps explicitly mapping the terrain with symbolic meaning in an attempt to trace their history and therefore their difference over a landscape that was once part and parcel of their common identity. The manner in which the cave ritual, although important for each tradition in its own way, suggests that when inter-religious activities interact in the same place, meanings collide and a new set of historical and interpretive imperatives emerge. Thus, different communities reify and sharpen religious identification to the extent that other identities of shared interest attenuate in importance. This is exemplified in the ritual tension inside the cave, in contrast to the general camaraderie and the sharing of the campsite. Could it be possible that the reification of these identities emphasize where boundaries begin and end, and the religious categories are gaining importance and fixity over other social and cultural ones? Thank you.
Thank you. Well, thank you very much. Very interesting talk. We've got time for questions.
You had quite a mention here about uprising in 1930s. What was that about? You know?
The uprising in 1930s, yeah. That was when Jadunong was accused, the first reformer, when he was accused of killing a few traders. And the British accused him for sacrificing the traders to and his gods. So in the 30s, there was a slight uprising then, and Jadunong was, of course, jailed and then tried and then hanged. People say that those allegations were primarily to kind of like set him up, you know, because he was gaining prominence as a leader. And presumably as well that in the 30s, you know, the Indian, you know, like nationalist movement was also, you know, spreading. So I think the British were quite scared of the whole thing. And so Jadunong's involvement, yeah, I think was kind of like, I think the charges were framed. But I don't know if I, yeah. Yeah.
What is the attitude of either of the groups towards those who are outsiders joining the group?
There weren't many outsiders there. They were primarily Paupai Chepriak and Haraka pilgrims, you know, who were there. There were some people who were going up to the Shiva temple. And I think on one occasion I saw a few Hindu pilgrims there, but I think there were only a handful there, so I can't really say what there. But I mean, the pilgrimage itself is just primarily for the Paupai Chepriak as well as the Haraka. I mean, I would guess they would be open to, you know, people. Yeah.
Thank you.
I mean, your material sort of suggests that there was originally some real animal sacrifice in the cave. You sort of skirted around that. I mean, can you just tell us? I mean, do you have any actual evidence that the animals were brought there and actually sacrificed?
In the 30s, actually, there's a report in the administrative report, actually, of Assam that in the cave, there were animals sacrificed. But sacrifice has kind of changed, you know, and I think, especially for the Haraka, sacrifice is seen as kind of like no-no. Traditionally, yes, I think sacrifices were there, but in contemporary times, I think sacrifices are kind of like seen as, you know.
There's nobody left who's still performing sacrifice.
The Popeye Chapriaks, in fact, I think still sacrifice, yes, but like not the Haraka. I think the whole idea of sacrifice is connected with the economic reforms, you know, which happened in the 30s. It was primarily because there was a famine, you know, of some sort, and so banning sacrifices was a way to kind of like counter, you know, the kind of famines, I would say, in the 30s. So they kind of like took that on, and the reforms, you know, suggest that, you know, these sacrifices were seen as kind of like demonic. And this, I suspect, is more kind of, I don't know, like retrospective, you know, like reading of what actually happened. Is that...
Well, just raise more questions. I don't want to monopolize.
Kevin,
Like, the surrounding religious landscape is also very marked by Christianity, right? So I was wondering, for example, among the Zeni and Hmong, there's also at the moment quite a strong revival movement. So I was wondering how that feeds into the Raqqa movement. Is there, for example, a marked tension within the community between those going on this kind of pilgrimages and those who are very strong revivalist Christians?
The presence of Christianity is also strong there, yes, I do admit that. But the pilgrimage, actually, it doesn't really clash, I think, you know, with the Christians, primarily because of the because they go to I think pilgrimage is seen as something which is people don't really think about it, you know. So, for example, the Christians don't really think about it and say, okay, fine, you know, and if they want to go, you know, it's okay with them. And that region where they go to pilgrimage is primarily Hindu and populated by the Paupai Chapriaks. So Christianity has a very, very small presence there. So it doesn't really conflict, you know, I think. But in other like regions, yes, the clash between the Haraka and Christians, I think, is quite you know, like visceral.
It's really interesting. You know, we're always taught that ritual spaces unite the community, and you're showing us a completely different angle, which is really fascinating. It just makes me try and identify what's divisive here, and whether there's also a unity phase of the whole ritual experience. It seems like the ritual actions are what divided the community in the cave. Like the whole grammar, the lexicon of what you're supposed to do when you did it. Was there also a phase of that experience? You talked for a while as well about being inside the cave and the experience that people had without any grammar or lexicon of ritual and nothing to argue about there. Was there a part where that division was not there? And before that,
before the sense of ethnic and religious divides kicked in at that stage? Was there kind of a an earlier phase which would accord with the idea that the ritual space unites everyone in the community and this liminal experience of unity as well? Was that only in the camps?
Well, I think in the camps, yes. You know, in the camps, there is a sense of sharing, you know, as well as, you know, like unity, etc., within the various groups. Historically, it's quite hard to say because historically, actually, it wasn't really a pilgrimage. The pilgrimage began only from, I think, the 60s and onwards. And the first record that we have of people attending the cave is in around the early 20s or so. And I think, you know, in that particular case, I think it was just kind of, you know, I don't know, like going there, as opposed to kind of an organized, you know, kind of journey there. And I think that happened primarily from the 60s. Originally, the cave was important only to the Haraka. And laterally, the Paupai Chapriak have also kind of, you know, like latched on and gone to the cave in a form of pilgrimage. So, I mean, there could have been, you know, some kind of, I don't know, like unity, I guess, you know, at some point. But I think the main point is that of sacrifices, you know? And I think that's the main thing that separates the Paupai Chapriak, you know, from the Haraka. And so, you know, historically, it's quite hard to say, but yeah, I mean, in the present context, yeah, that's the case, yeah. Hey, Barry.
Yeah. Do you think is an expectation of these people, and did you see any evidence of what you might call transcendental experience? Is that something that is an intrinsic part of it, or hoped for, or
transcendental experience, as in what? I mean, I mean, like smoking and being high, or
I think a sense of perhaps feeling one with, let's call it the universe, the cosmos, or whatever. You know, rather than just going through a ritual because it's what's been done before, and there's some kind of feeling inside you that it's the thing to do. You know, I'm wondering if people know what a transcendental experience is. I think I've had them before. I'm just wondering if that would be seen as maybe being an end point or the ultimate experience of actually undergoing that ritual.
Well, I can't really say much about transcendental experiences as such, but people do see the cave as well as the pilgrimage as timeless. So, you know, they're connecting, you know, with ancestors and gods and tradition and so on and so forth. So I guess in that sense, yes, you know, the sacred, you know, is there within history as well as they kind of experience it as a timeless thing. With regard to the transcendental bit, I don't know.
Yeah, maybe in part of something bigger I was thinking about, and maybe that's what the experience of by somebody doing that.
Yeah. It could be interesting, yeah, that angle, yes.
I mean, you gave us a few examples of appearances of a goddess.
Yeah.
Those kind of things. I just wanted to bring back the discussion to the relationship between the two groups, and you've got this fairly neat distinction between the ritual space and non-religious environments, and it's only within religious ritual space that conflict is somewhat exacerbated and differences are somewhat exacerbated. And I was just wondering whether there are instances of clashes between members of the two groups in non-religious contexts, and whether people do use religious terms, religious language in a way to frame those conflicts, say, you know, you're an animal sacrificer, or not an animal sacrificer.
I think the assumption is there. I think in non-religious contexts, I think people do talk about, you know, the other group as people who sacrifice, and I think it's implicit. but it's not very explicit. And primarily in the cave, I mean, like the whole kind of like in the campsite, you know, I think it was a lot of exchanges. They were sharing food and, you know, they were sharing songs and so on and so forth. So I don't think it was explicit, you know, in the non-religious sphere. So, and the cave is the one of the places where the Haraka and the Papua Chapriaks, they kind of like converge. So, I mean, in the campsite, there was no indication of any kind of conflict or animosity explicitly. But it's strange that why, you know, in the ritual space, they tend to have conflict. And then, of course, you know, I've talked about this. It's primarily because of the sacrifices thing, which kind of is seen as quite, you know, divisive. In other contexts outside the campsite, you know, I don't really know, because my experience was primarily inside that kind of, I guess, in the hill and, you know, the...
That could be an interesting route in a way. I mean, if you...
Yes.
To answer your last question at the end of the paper, as to whether there's
exactly,
something
yeah.
specific about...
I agree with you, yes. I mean, my research was primarily with the Haraka, so, you know, I was kind of, like, you know, with them. And I didn't... I mean, like, of course, you know, I did speak a bit with the Papua Chapriak, but, you know, I didn't kind of, you know, interact with them a lot, you know, as I did, you know, with the Haraka. So, yeah. I mean, I guess this is something that, you know, could be done in the future, you know, kind of see, you know, how the Papua Chapriaks, you know, also kind of, I don't know, view the Haraka and so on and so forth. Yeah. Thank you. Yeah.
I mean, just to follow up on that, but you must have some sense of whether the Haraka interact with the Papua Chapriak on a kind of everyday basis, or whether they're living in totally separate villages. And
well, they.
This is the only. Is this the only?
It, yeah.
In which they actually interact.
No. Of course not. I mean. The Haraka, they come from not... They come from Haflong, which is, you know, like north of Assam. And the Papua Chapriaks are primarily in the south of Assam. So, in that sense, they don't have any sort of, you know, interaction going on, you know, on an everyday kind of thing. But... in the Zemi regions, the Papua Chapriaks are called Palpaise. And that's, again, slightly, you know, different. Now, the Palpaise and the Papua Chapriaks, they kind of, like, have some sort of connection, I guess. But the Papua Chapriaks are, again, they are slightly more, like, reformed and also influenced a lot by... thing like Vaishnavism there, while the Palpaise are, again, you know, like different. So I mean, it's quite a confusing situation here, you know, with all the kind of groups. So I think the interaction with the Papua Chapriaks and the Haraka happened primarily in the cave. Yeah.
I'd like to ask one last quick question before we finish, and that's the when the Palpai, I was impressed, struck by the Palpai Chakriya offering the chicken, and it flew to the altar, and the Heraka Pujari got upset about it. So what happens to the chicken after? Do they take it, do they sacrifice it?
They don't, I mean, yeah, this comes back to the whole thing about sacrifice. But the Haraka elder just ignored it, and it was just there.
So they take their animals back home?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Well, I mean, the Palpai Chapriak will... the the priest will come down and take the animals, and they will either kill it and cook it, you know, for their thing, or they sell it. But sacrifices in that cave itself is outlawed now.
But there isn't a sense of the animal having been consecrated or something like that once it's kind of been offered. It's not set aside from other kind of animals.
Inside the cave, I didn't quite see that. In the temples, yes. I mean, like, I think it was quite. It's quite evident, you know, in the temples that the animals who were kind of in the given, you know, were kind of set aside, and were kind of they were used primarily for the priests as well as the temples. In terms of blood sacrifices, I'm not really sure, and I don't think it really happens there. Yeah.
If I were a god, I'd get annoyed if somebody offered me a chicken and took it back home. Anyway, thank you very much for a very interesting stimulation.
No problem. Thank you.
And thank you all for turning up.
Thank you.